TalkLine Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.
What are we gonna do with our children? What are we gonna do to show we care? How are we gonna be there for our children when they feel that life has just not been that fair?
Good evening and welcome back to Mask's weekly radio show on Family Matters. Mask, mothers and fathers aligned, saving kids. Kids of all ages and all stages for all mental health issues. If you know someone that needs a support group for parents, an inpatient or outpatient clinic, inpatient rehab, feel free to give us a call. You can call anonymously at 718-758-0400. Again, I will repeat the number, maybe for yourself, a neighbor, a loved one, someone you usually would sit next to in shul. Our number again, 718-758-0400. This month, the month of May, it is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I can't think of anyone better to interview tonight than the famous Dr. Jacob Friedman, who is a board certified psychiatrist and business consultant who is based in Jerusalem. After completing his training as an award-winning chief resident at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Dr. Friedman and his wife followed their lifelong dream and made Aliyah to Israel with their family. Dr. Friedman is a popular columnist for Mishpacha magazine, and unfortunately, with the tragic, tragic event, so painful, in Meron, just this past week, Dr. Friedman, I am so grateful for you coming on because I know how busy you are running from yeshiva to yeshiva, helping students and rebbes and moras deal with the mental health of their students. So thank you for coming on and making the time tonight.
Mrs. Clapman, yashar koach for all of the amazing work that you do, as well as the team at Mask. Obviously, we're talking about one of the most long organizations within the belt when it comes to fighting the stigma of illness and getting families and our loved ones the support that they need. So truly a big zechus of mine to be here schmoozing with you tonight about how we can help our community.
Thank you. And like you said, I can't do it alone without my wonderful staff. So let's get right to it. I mean, there's so much pain, with what happened in Meron, the pandemic, so many families struggling, whether it's anxiety, whether bipolar, schizophrenia, eating disorders, whatever mental illness they may be struggling with. I'd like you first, for my listeners, to explain what are the benefits of seeing a psychiatrist and how a psychiatrist could help with significant changes in one's life, please.
So I think there's a lot of stigma and concern about what it means to see a psychiatrist. And I think that one of our goals tonight should be to dispel a lot of the confusions, myths, and stereotypes involved with seeing a psychiatrist. I have a colleague who's a well-known lawyer, and he always jokes and says, "How do you know if you need to see a lawyer? At the moment when you think you need to see a lawyer, it's time to go see a lawyer." So I generally tell people, if you think maybe you should see a psychiatrist, you should definitely see a psychiatrist. And that's because psychiatrists are doctors. We are physicians, MDs, who are trained at understanding the way that the mind interacts with the rest of the body. In some cases, that's assessing the needs for medication, for which psychiatrists are famous for doing and infamous for doing, certainly. But in other cases, it's very helpful to clarify the diagnosis, to help people understand how drugs and alcohol can affect the brain, to help families and their loved ones understand how medications and different treatments affect the brain and the rest of the body. And in general, just to provide a safe and non-judgmental place to talk about concerns, risky and dangerous behaviors. So in general, I think it's a fantastic idea to see a psychiatrist. And Baruch Hashem, there's no shortage of good doctors that are trained and able to help our community.
Yes, and I just want to mention Nefesh International Executive Board member. Nefesh has over almost 900 from Jewish therapists, and anybody that needs a referral around the world, you can call 718-758-0400. Doctor, I really want to explain about understanding inpatient. What's the difference between outpatient seeing a psychiatrist and a client being inpatient in a treatment center in a psych ward, whether they go involuntarily or voluntarily? If you can talk about both, please.
Certainly. So that's a great question, Mrs. Klapman, and it's an important distinction for us to make. Outpatient psychiatric treatment is when a individual and their loved ones will go to visit the doctor at the doctor's office, which sometimes can be located in a hospital, sometimes in the community. And that's an opportunity to discuss diagnosis, treatment, safety, recovery, and all sorts of things. Inpatient psychiatric treatment is sometimes called the psych ward, sometimes called a psych hospital. This is a place where patients who are acutely struggling with mental illness can go to be safe. Now, everybody needs to be safe. And sometimes the safest place to be is at home and with one's loved ones. Other times, the most important place to be safe is a locked psychiatric hospital. In many cases, that's for people who are suicidal, people who are hurting themselves, people who are potentially violent and hurting others, or for people who are unable to care for themselves. And the classic example of that is a person who's psychotic, has schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and is paranoid, delusional, and has disorganized behaviors, is unable to eat or sleep properly. And these illnesses, it's the safest place to be in a locked hospital where there are staff available 24/7 to ensure the safety of everyone. Now, it's certainly daunting to go to a psychiatric hospital. It can be scary. These can be places where there are other sick people, and these can be places that may or may not seem quite frightening to go to. That being said, psychiatric hospitalization saves lives by providing a safe and structured environment to prevent suicide, to prevent violence, trouble with the law, trouble in the community. And I generally tell people, if you don't need to be in a psych hospital, there's no need to go to one. But if you do need to go to a psych hospital, it's the most important place to be. And if I'm correct, Mrs. Klapman, you asked about the difference between a voluntary hospitalization and an involuntary hospitalization. So a voluntary hospitalization is where a patient, quote, signs themselves in. A patient says, I'm too depressed to be outside of the hospital. I need more support. I need to feel safe. I am too scared to be out of the hospital. I feel like my medications need adjusting, and I'm concerned that I wouldn't be safe or that I don't know what to do. So I'd like to stay in the hospital until I'm feeling calmer. That's a voluntary hospitalization. An involuntary hospitalization is what happens when the legal system is involved and a patient says, I don't want to go to a hospital, but the doctors involved in their care, the police and the court system, as well as the families, sit down and make a decision that has v'chalilas, something could happen to this individual if they don't get help and they don't get help fast. And the judge will make a ruling based on the doctor's opinion, the family's collateral information, and will come up with a plan for treatment in the hospital, even though it's against the patient's wishes at that time. Now, that sounds very scary. I just want to be very honest. That sounds terribly frightening, that the doctors and the courts are going to take somebody away from their family and lock them up against their will and give them medicines against their will. I mean, that sounds like everyone's worst nightmare. Now, I should just say that having been to court hearings to speak on behalf of my patients and their families, the judges do not want to lock people up against their will. The doctors do not want to lock people up against their will. But when a person is dangerous to themselves, to others, and is unable to take care of themselves, a forced hospitalization can save their lives. And I can't tell you how many patients and their families have told me that locked hospitalization felt terrible during the moment, but after they got better, that it mamish saved their lives. And keep in mind that, again, while this is quite scary, there are laws that prevent unjust hospitalization and protect the rights of patients. So only in a situation where hospitalization is required as the, quote, least restrictive environment of care that can safely treat a patient is that proceeded with according to the judge's ruling. I think if people are interested in this, there was an article by Judge Mostovsky, who is a firm judge in Brooklyn, in the Ami magazine a few months ago, that has a pretty good review for patients and their families who might be interested in learning more.
Yes, thank you. I do want to touch on the topic again of duo diagnosis. Those that don't understand, if you can please explain.
Yeah, certainly. So dual diagnosis means that a patient has both a primary mental illness, something like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, as well as a problem with substance use and addiction. And this is really a challenging situation because in many cases, a patient who has an acute mental illness and is using drugs and alcohol will exacerbate the symptoms of their mental illness and make it harder to treat. So a dual diagnosis program is aimed at addressing both substance use and acute mental illness. Dual diagnosis hospitals and facilities have the resources to provide patients with coping skills aimed at recovery and sobriety, oftentimes with 12-step programming and other specific treatments aimed at promoting sustained sobriety.
So the one question that we get on our helpline, Dr., very too often is it okay to get medication from our pediatrician for my child that's ADD, or from my pediatrician whose, you know, daughter is suffering with mental illness? If you can discuss the difference between getting it from a regular doctor, internist, and getting it from a psychiatrist, please.
Yeah, so I would say that this is something that is certainly better than getting medications from an OSCON or from somebody in the community that has an illegal pharmacy gemach in their basement, but it's not ideal. And I'll give you a mushel. If there is a guy who you've hired to come to your house as a carpenter and build shelves in your children's room, and he looks down at the floor and says, "It looks like you got a pipe leak here, and I'm pretty good as a plumber. Why don't I go ahead and take a peek at that and fix it for you as well?" The MS is, he might know more about plumbing than you do, but I would still recommend calling a plumber before your pipes explode from a guy who doesn't know what he's doing. So again, please forgive my dear colleagues. Forgive me if I'm doubting your expertise in psychiatry, but I think that most pediatricians and primary care doctors that I know will recognize the need for a psychiatrist's input in the care of their patients with mental health challenges, and that sometimes pediatricians and internal medicine doctors are very savvy and do have some additional training in mental health fields and can do a good job of starting the process. But getting a psychiatrist involved in a case where psychiatric medications are being prescribed is absolutely critical. Again, in the same way that any patient who's being prescribed medications for their heart should see a cardiologist, and any patient who's having Crohn's disease or colitis should see a gastroenterologist, any patient who's been diagnosed with a psychiatric condition, whether it's depression, ADHD, anxiety, should certainly see a psychiatrist in an expeditious fashion, at least to confirm the diagnosis and the basic treatment plan. In Israel, it is worth noting that primary care physicians cannot prescribe many psychiatric medications. They can only be prescribed by a psychiatrist, which is certainly different than it is in the States. And I don't know that one is better than the other, but it is worth pointing out that at least there's a havamina, there's an idea that psychiatric medications should be started and maintained by psychiatrists.
Thank you for that. Doctor, many thousands and thousands of young adults go to Israel for the school year when they graduate 12th grade, the following year, seminaries. And they go for a year or two, some for longer. Young adults that are there now, they went through a hard year with the pandemic, now with the Meron tragedy. What are you seeing from these students that you're visiting in their schools?
Yeah, so I think that the prevalence of anxiety disorders and depression have certainly been notably increased over the past year as opposed to prior years due to the stress of quarantine, separation from family, inability to do positive coping exercises like cardiovascular exercise on a daily basis. Isolation from peers and family has been certainly a big challenge. I've seen some statistics that suggest that your average young person is about 30% likely to have some sort of anxiety disorder over the past year. And that's just not surprising to me, given how stressful things have been. Over the past week, Letzar Reinu Arabim, there were so many people who were either at Meron, lost somebody that they knew and loved, or were exposed to this horrific tragedy that affected all of Klal Yisrael. There was nobody who didn't know somebody. Again, I had a patient who was at four funerals, and it's not because he loves being Menachem Avil. This is a terrible situation, and having symptoms of anxiety, of depression, is not surprising. And the most important thing to do is to recognize when you're struggling and to reach out for help before it becomes a more significant problem. I always tell my patients that if you treat something when you're first struggling with it, it's a lot easier to treat. It gets better faster, and the treatment itself is not so invasive, but that people who wait longer and who are struggling more severely are more likely to end up taking psychiatric medications in addition to therapy, and sometimes multiple medications depending on the severity of their condition. So it's so important to really nip things in the bud and to reach out for help when you need it. And on that note, it's so important for us as community members, as parents, brothers, sisters, children, chavrusas, neighbors, to look out and see that our fellow Yidden are struggling, and somebody who used to be quite outgoing and happy-go-lucky, who's experienced a lot of stress and is struggling, it's not inappropriate to say, Yossi, I see you're having a tough time. Rivka, I just want to let you know I'm here to talk. You don't have to play psychologist. You don't have to do anything other than tell them I care about you. And I think it seems like you're having a tough time. Do you want to go for a walk? Do you want to schmooze? And to let them know about great organizations like MASC that provide confidential crisis intervention and referral services to get people the help that they need in a timely fashion before things snowball out of control.
Thank you. Dr. Friedman, at MASC, we tell parents, if your child's going into rehab or your child's going into a psych ward, the parents should definitely be part of a group, whether it's for mental health, but for Enochaskeno, there's so many organizations, including MASC, that offers groups for parents so that they themselves learn about their child's illness, mental illness, and then they can know what to do and, more importantly, what not to do and what not to expect or yes to expect. So what do you feel about that parent involvement, please?
Yeah, so we know, based on large research studies, that when parents of children who are struggling with mental health issues are better educated and better supported throughout the process, that there are less adverse outcomes, including suicide, violence, and hospitalizations. This original studies were done on the National Alliance of Mental Illness, NAMI, their family-to-family groups, which I know have been replicated within the Frum community with organizations such as the ones that you named. And when parents have a better understanding of what is helpful and what is not helpful, what is dangerous and what is not dangerous, what can be expected as a reasonable outcome and what is an unreasonable outcome and unreasonable expectations that place further stress on the situation. When parents, quote, get it, they're able to advocate for their children throughout the system. They're able to support their children, and they're able to support themselves through very difficult challenges. And the MS is knowing you're not alone provides so much chizuk and can get a family through what can otherwise be a terrible personal tragedy. So I'm a tremendous supporter, and I always advocate for my patients that their families should be involved in peer support groups, and that these groups are confidential. These groups provide loving support. These groups don't want anything out of you other than for you to feel that you have the support, the knowledge, and the koyach to help your loved one who's struggling with mental health issues.
Thank you. Dr. Friedman, my last question is, can you explain if a teenager is admitted to a hospital at 16, 17, a parent could get information, but what happens if they're in the treatment center and they turn 18, and now that child could sign and say, I don't want my parents' involvement. Can you just explain that, please, for parents? Because it is very frustrating for parents when they cannot be involved in the treatment of their loved one.
Certainly. And confidentiality is a double-edged sword in that it both protects the family and the patient themselves, but it also can cause a lot of challenges with communication and miscommunication. So parents should know that even if the doctor can't reveal information about the patient, that the parents can always share information with the doctor. And I always tell parents, the doctor might not be able to tell you exactly what medications child is taking, but you can share information about the medications that have worked in the past and the ones that haven't worked in the past, for example. You can share information that the child has smoked marijuana, has done drugs in the past, whether or not the doctor can share with you the results of their urine drug toxicity screen. So the information that you share, that's vital information. And just because the doctor can't share back doesn't mean that you can't help the doctor to care for your child. I also tell parents that a good doctor wants to involve you, and that a good doctor is going to try and involve you. And if you feel like that's not happening and you have any ability to affect change, respectfully bring that up with the treatment team, that we're good folks, we're trying to help. And if you feel like you're getting stonewalled in the process, and your child is in a rehab, your child is in a hospital, you can always work with the patient relations department or the human rights officer to try and figure out any of these issues that might be occurring as part of care should a parent not be involved in the care of their child. So I know that we're getting towards the end of the interview, Mrs. Klapman, but again, I just wanted to say a groyser yasher koyach on all of the tremendous work that you're doing in the community, and I wish you a lot of hatzlacha, as well as your team and all of the great work that you're doing on behalf of our community. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on, and Hashem should give you the koach that you need to help those that are suffering so badly now in Israel. And let's all remember that this month is Mental Health Awareness Week, month actually, and tonight's show is in memory of my dear mother. Today is her yahrzeit, Ita Bas Lomo. And let's always remember, hang in, hold on, and virtually hug tight. I want to wish everybody a very good evening, a beautiful Shabbos. Thank you, and have a good night.
Are you interested in hosting your own radio show and podcast, or perhaps a TV program? TalkLine Network can help you get on the air from 1 hour weekly to 24 hours a day. Ideal for ethnic, foreign language, medical, business, and religious broadcasting. We also have full-time radio stations for lease, as well as FM HD channels. For more information, please call 212-769-1925. That's 212-769-1925. Or email zevrenner@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening.
TalkLine Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network. the voice of the Jewish community.